The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
Chris Hedges, welcome to the Fearless Podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing good, TD. How are you?
Great, great. I really want to appreciate and thank you for coming on. I reached out to you at the last second. We were able to schedule this. Chris Hedges, for those of you that don't know, is one of Jeremy Brown's attorneys. And I'll let Chris explain all of this to y'all, but he agreed to come on to kind of update us all. So Chris, maybe we could start out. I know there's a lot of people, unfortunately, that don't even know who Jeremy Brown is. So maybe we could start out with an explanation of who is Jeremy Brown and kind of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important because of Jeremy's actual background is kind of the thing that caused everything to take place. So Jeremy is a 20-year Special Operations Combat veteran. 17 of those years was spent in the Green Berets, which means he is an expert in covert compartmentalized clandestine operations. That's what they do downrange when they're working with recruiting assets and building forces to help fight wars where the Americans can kind of back out. It's training the locals to do the military's job. And that's kind of my understanding of what they are, which is basically what Jeremy has described January 6th as a covert clandestine operation organized against the American people. And there's two gentlemen that really can talk very eloquently about that. That would be Jeff McCullough and Jeremy Brown, based on their professional experience. There may be others, but I know them specifically. And as a Green Beret, Jeremy became very valuable because he's got a skill set that is beneficial even to the federal government for purposes of confidential human sources. And for anyone who really doesn't know what a confidential human source is, that's an individual, regular citizen, you, me, whatever, that the government says, hey, you know, would you like to work with us? You know, we can pay you. You know, and, you know, they can do certain things. And there's a lot of interesting things about this that, you know, is kind of beyond the scope of what we'll talk about today. But there are actual reports in the FBI as to what the confidential human sources can say, do, et cetera. And there's even a special provision that if a confidential human source is going to do something illegal in the furtherance of what they're doing, that can theoretically be done. It just has to be documented by the FBI properly. And there might be a file of criminal activity that CHSs have done based on this system that is set up for the reporting of confidential human sources. But
back up? Because sure. I don't think a lot of people know that Jeremy Brown is currently incarcerated as being involved in the J6. And a lot of people right now think all the J6ers have been pardoned. They all have not been pardoned. Jeremy Brown is still in custody, still serving time. And it's basically that one part of the charges against him were dropped. But he is a FBI whistleblower. He blew the whistle on the FBI. And basically, because he blew the whistle on the FBI, these charges, in my opinion, are a retaliation of that.
I believe it's even more than that. And I don't know if we'll have time to get into all the details, but I'd say it's beyond even the fact that he's a whistleblower. Yeah. So on November 18th, 2020, and let me sit there and go back. Jeremy is in FCI Atlanta. That's the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, which is the furthest away from his house that he can be without being outside the guidelines for the system. He's 455 miles from home. And as Jeremy has told me, it's actually supposedly the worst facility in the system. I don't know. I would think any of them and all of them are the same. But yeah, you know, on December 21st, 2025, Jeremy was pardoned by Ed Martin. His case was dismissed in D.C. by Ed Martin, and it was based on the pardon. What happened, though, was The FBI and DOJ manufactured two cases against Jeremy, one that took place previously in Tampa that he was convicted on based on property that was located in his residence and in his RV that was found based on a unconstitutional, facially deficient search warrant. That property included three different things that Jeremy has alleged all along were planted evidence. Two M67 grenades and a CD that was labeled classified documentation. The interesting thing about that is that CD, the jury sat there and said, hold on, for all of these things that have happened within here, we don't think beyond a reasonable doubt that was his. We don't think he actually had that. And they acquitted him of those four charges connected to that CD. And I think part of the thing that we need to look at, you know, when you're talking about just like optics, well, a classified CD, that the only way you're getting it is from someone who's got access to DOD material and grenades that are in the possession of the military. What do they have in common? The person who got those things had to be DOD. So if theoretically you can reasonably come to the conclusion that that CD is planted evidence, for me, it's a foregone conclusion that even beyond the forensic evidence that proves that those grenades really were never Jeremy's, they should also have been, any of the charges concerning them should have been, he should have been acquitted of as well. You know, by the mere fact that likely the person who got that CD also got those grenades.
Right. And the forensic evidence around that evidence has no ties to Jeremy, no link DNA. It was other guy's DNA on it, somebody else's dog. So it appears that clearly that evidence was planted. And so not only are the charges fabricated, the actual evidence to incriminate him was planted. So it definitely looks incredibly criminal, not on his behalf, and it definitely looks like they have an axe to grind.
Well, and I'm gonna tell you why, but I want to sit there before we move on to anywhere. I want to talk about the forensics that we've just talked about, because there's an interesting thing that no one has brought up yet, or no one has brought up in a meaningful capacity. On those grenades, when they cut the tape off and they reviewed what was there, they found the DNA of carpet fibers of a dog, and the DNA of two individuals, no fingerprints. The dog hair did not match either of his dogs, Liberty or Ranger. The carpet fibers or the fibers that were there didn't match anything in the RV or the residence. And the DNA, despite the fact that the FBI lowered the threshold standards for analyzing it, did not match Jeremy. Now, when we sit there and look at that, the reason I say that this becomes a really big question is, Jeremy was listed as a co-defendant or as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Oath Keepers case. And the federal government attempted to use the evidence in Jeremy's Tampa case against the Oath Keepers before it had ever even been admitted into evidence in his Tampa case. So no jury, no prosecutor ever even admitted it in. They just said, hey, judge, this evidence is down there and we're going to use it. And you can see that in document 187 from Jeremy's or from the Oath Keepers case, and I could get you that information if you wanted to see it, because you can pull it up. Anybody can go look at document 187. It's public record. But here's the thing. What else happened on January 6th? Because there were some other explosives that supposedly came out. I believe that there was supposedly an IED that was left in front of the DNC and an IED that was left in front of the RNC. Well, okay, those are explosives, and Jeremy's the only person I know who's accused of having explosives. Wouldn't it make sense for the FBI to want to interview Jeremy Brown as to that other potential person? I mean, maybe that was Jeremy Brown up there. Maybe we should talk to him about that. Or maybe it's one of the two people on his DNA who's on those grenades that we didn't sit there and look up. They never sat there and looked for, to the best of our knowledge, they've never looked for who that DNA belonged to. And second, they've never, the FBI, no one at the DOJ has ever interviewed Jeremy Brown. So if you're telling me he's a unindicted co-conspirator on seditious conspiracy, and you're trying to sit there and look for somebody who supposedly dropped off explosives, and you're doing a legitimate investigation, shouldn't you actually talk to the one guy that you supposedly found explosives on?
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. So the one charges were dropped. He's now still being held on these charges of this planted evidence. Where is he in the process now? What's his next step in his process?
So there's a couple things that are happening actively. On March 6th, he'll have oral arguments for his appeal. And in his appeal, he's challenging a couple of different things. He's making some arguments as to the constitutionality of the search based on the search warrant. He's challenging the fact that the firearms, based on Supreme Court case precedent, are not illegal. And he was rightfully, you know, possessing them. So those charges should be dismissed because those two firearms fall within what the Second Amendment authorized an individual to have. And then he's challenging based on a violation to his Fifth Amendment rights, where one of the prosecutors went so far as to say, in relying on what I believe was a manipulation of jailhouse phone calls, based on what they actually did and what they presented to the jury, that Jeremy's silence could be inferred or taken as a confession. And I thought there was this thing called the Fifth Amendment where you had the right to remain silent. But I mean, apparently when prosecutors want to guarantee a conviction, that's not maybe not the case. And here's the thing that's even worse about it. That specific audio recording where they said his silence is a confession, the jury sent a note out to the judge saying, hey, judge, the CD of that audio call is not playing here. We'd like to hear it again. Well, to me, that tells me that they wanted to hear that because that audio call was so important that it was going to help decide something. So let me tell you some stuff that most people probably don't know. That audio call they relied on, it was about a minute 45 long, maybe a minute 35. They played the part all the way up to the point where they hear his girlfriend say, they found grenades and they have to explode, you know, they have to take them off and detonate them. Jeremy didn't, you know, okay, he didn't say anything. The call cuts out. In the next 40 seconds, you hear Jeremy go, hello, are you there? Hello, hello, I can't hear you. Are you there? Indicating, at least in that call right there, that, oh, by the way, that call shows that maybe he didn't hear what she had to say. But that isn't the only thing that happened. The next call he made that connected through, he goes through and he says, hey, I've tried four phones and they're all broken. And you hear him and his girlfriend go back and forth. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Because they're still having problems. And you hear Jeremy say, hey, I'm going to try and manipulate the wire here so that maybe I can get better reception. And that call ends. And then he has a third call. And in the third call, he goes, hey, you know, I've tried eight phones and none of them have been working. You know, I'm going to try another one. And they're still doing the, hey, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? And I apologize to your audience, but I want to sit there and I actually want to quote Jeremy Wendt with what he says in call number four. He goes through the process of, you know, calling the fourth time, and the fourth time at about the fourth minute mark in the call, he finally hears his girlfriend say, hey, they, you know, I just want to let you know, they say they found grenades and they've got to take them off site to detonate them before they can continue. His immediate reaction to that was, that's okay. So when he actually does hear what she has to say about this issue, that's his instantaneous reaction. And the next part, a little further into that audio call, is, you know, we know that this is a setup. We knew that this was coming, you know, because I came out as a whistleblower. And, you know, just, you know, go through the steps and make sure everybody knows about it. The jury never heard call two, three, or four, and they didn't hear the second half of call number one, which for me is like, hey, how can we misrepresent this first 46 seconds of this call to sit there and show the jury that, hey, they need to convict him on having these grenades? What would the jury have done had they sat there and they had heard all of that? I'm pretty sure that they would have sat there and began by saying, you know what? Those grenades are planted. And that means that three additional charges go away, just like the CD charge. And then what I think would have happened is the count 10, which was another classified material charge, which was bogus. And the reason that I also believe that he's being held in captivity at this point in time, they would have sat there and then they would have questioned that charge. Like, I don't know if this guy's telling me the truth. The only charges he may have been convicted of were the two firearms charges. But I mean, at that point in time, now does the jury want to sit there and do something that every judge and every lawyer tells them not to do, which is engage in jury nullification and say, this is hopelessly BS. We're going to sit there and we're doing X, Y, and Z. You know, I don't know the facts behind it, but I know it happens all the time. You get somebody who, despite what the law says, is like, yeah, I'm not convicted. And
we're in an entirely different position based on 1 46-second audio.
Yeah, that's insane. So at what would, so in order, are there any legal ramifications to those that planted the evidence? If, you know, if you make that case in court and the judge rules that obviously this evidence was planted, are there any ramifications?
So, I mean, if
that happens,
you know, it's, I think we'd be speculating because there's different avenues all over the place. So let's look at what happens just in his appeal right now. Theoretically, a remedy that the appellate court could give him as a direct result of the violation of his Fifth Amendment rights is reverse the case at the lower district level. You know, essentially say that, you know, the constitutional violations are so egregious at the lower court that we have to reverse what took place and the court needs to dismiss with prejudice. That would vacate his charges and, you know, send him on his way. His constitutional challenge to the search warrant, the issues there, if done properly, could theoretically do the same thing. His focus on his middle claim focusing on the Second Amendment could do that specifically to those two gun charges. And so he could sit there and have that resolved there. What I think really should be looked at now that you're talking about an administration that has come in is criminal activity engaged in the purposes of this. And here's the thing. I reasonably believe that the federal government could sit there and say, yeah, it has. There are two criminal charges that are deprivation of rights charges. If anyone sits there and engages in activities that, you know, deprive you of your constitutional or your rights protected under the laws of the United States, you can be subject to criminal penalty under law, under statute 18 U.S.C. 242. Basically, it criminalizes the violation of your rights, which we just walked through what may have just happened with his Fifth Amendment rights. So was there a criminal act right there to sit there and violate his right to remain silent for purposes of securing a conviction? There's a conspiracy charge as well, which is 18 U.S.C. 241, which is the exact same verbiage. So theoretically, there could, you know, the Department of Justice could be looking at a potential criminal case against its own for what it did in that case. Do I believe it'll do that? I don't know. You know, and the other thing is with timing of everything, it's tough because you're talking about people who have so many things that they've got going on. So, you know, does the right person hear about this? Does the right person far enough up the food chain sit there and make sure it happens? Yeah. You know, we're talking about any number of variables that, you know, I couldn't even begin to quantify.
Now, I know these are federal charges. Is there anything that Ron DeSantis can do, you know, from the state of Florida standpoint?
Directly for the case? No. You know, I don't have a lot of faith in Ron DeSantis for reasons I'm going to discuss. I just don't. But what could take place is, I mean, here the constituents of the state of Florida having their rights violated, what have you. All the state of Florida has to do is comply with the basic requirements of what they have to do based on, I guess, the supremacy clause. You know, federal government has some stuff in place and you can't interfere and blah, blah, blah. But federal government can't force you to do something. You know, theoretically, you know, the governor, through his powers as the chief executive, could sit there and say, well, the state of Florida is now going to do the bare minimum to help the federal government in anything. And oh, by the way, all of these federal agencies that are currently here, you know, doing X, Y, Z, we really don't want you here anymore. We don't want you trying to maintain our land, which you claimed as federal, which I don't even believe they can sit there and do that, you know, based on what lands the federal government is supposed to actually be able to own, based on the Constitution. So, I mean, if Ron DeSantis wanted to, he probably could. He probably could do some things that, you know, make it uncomfortable for the federal government to be a true partner with the state of Florida. Will he do that? I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, that's why he got elected, you know, to make really tough choices like that. And it's real easy for someone like me or you to try and be like, hey,
from the cheap seats playing, Monday morning quarterback to judge what he's doing. We don't know all the information he's got. I wouldn't want to take a shot at somebody like that. It's theoretically yes, but realistically, maybe not.
Yeah, and I you bring up a lot of good points, and I think Allstate should be doing stuff like this. If we're going to, if the power is coming back to the states, right, and they're going to be allowed to function as independent states, that's definitely a tool that each state has to help dilute the bureaucracy and stuff the genie back in the bottle. So, okay, so there's a hearing on March 6th, I think you said?
Yes, so his official oral argument takes place on March 6th. That's where his lawyer and the government are going to both go in and argue their sides of what's there. Here's what else I know. I've provided documentation to Congress. I don't know if they've received it yet, but it talks about everything that's currently here. As early as July 4th, I had contacted Representative Barry Loudermilk's office to ensure that Jeremy could be called as a whistleblower because of everything he knows. And, I've reached out, and that system is currently going on. I'm in the process of trying to get the same documentation, which was originally produced for Pam Bondi, to the new United States Attorney General. I don't know whether or not she's got that yet. I believe that once United States Attorney Pam Bondi sees what I've put in her hands, which is not simply me walking through the facts of the case that systematically undermine any argument that there would be to keep Jeremy in custody, but I support every statement that I put in there with either a public document or a piece of discovery. So it's not like, hey, listen to me. It's like, here's what I'm saying, and here's what you look at. And I did her a big solid when I did it, and I cleaned up the vast majority of the paper, and I only gave her the relevant parts, and I only gave her the most relevant of documentation. What the federal government is looking at is the most streamlined version as to why Jeremy Brown should be free. And, I'm hoping that once that gets to their desks, someone's going to sit there and be like, oh my goodness, why is he there? And I'm hoping before March 6th that United States Attorney General Pam Bondi, has a discussion with the acting United States Attorney for the Middle District of Florida and says, hey, here's what I'm seeing. We need to address this. Go take care of it. And, so there have been, some recommendations based on what has been done with other people, like, for example, Chris Quaglin, who had an appellate case like Jeremy's vacated at the appellate level and remanded down to the district court for purposes of dismissal with prejudice, which basically says the charges are no longer there. They're gone. That was the request that was made and highlighted in the documentation that was provided. It's the same request that other people have made. The only thing is, it's not like I have the attorney general's direct contact and I can sit there and be like, hey, here it is. I'm really just relying on other people to hopefully get my message to her.
And maybe I heard this wrong, but did the current administration make a promise to Jeremy Brown's family?
So what happened was midway through 2022, maybe 2023, I don't know the dates, there was an event that took place down in Mar-a-Lago. And at the event, some of the January 6th families were invited down to meet the 45th president of the United States. And, they were in Mar-a-Lago, and it was a point where they got to advocate for the president, to the president for their loved ones and all January 6th generally. I wasn't there, so I can't tell you exactly what took place. But basically, from what I understood, the president was extremely upset with everything that he had seen, and he had said that he was going to take care of this. He would not let this injustice stand. I don't know, what was said to anyone beyond that. And I think that's kind of when you hear people say promises made, promises kept. I think that's the type of thing that they're referring to. I don't have any firsthand knowledge, so, what have you. I don't I don't think that we're at a point where anyone has broken promises. And this is my opinion, and you know, Jeremy would probably hate that I say it, but I mean, I look at it, and it's, I think there is a couple technicalities that are there that just haven't gotten figured out. And as soon as they are figured out, Jeremy Brown will be released. I just believe it's not there yet.
Yeah, and for anybody that wants like a little bit more background information, you can go to, and I'll link everything down below, but you can go to whoisjeremybrown.com. You can listen to the audio recording when he was approached by the FBI. You can look at other, there's lots of updates there. It's a great resource. You can donate to his legal defense fund. How's he doing on his defense fund? Because I'm sure this isn't cheap.
It's not cheap. I mean, when you sit there and you look at it, Jeremy Brown's had multiple cases, like full cases. So, I mean, his Tampa case alone was probably close to $200,000. His appeal of that case, currently ongoing, I believe is like $75,000 to $90,000. You know, he's been very fortunate that, you know, for DC, it was pro bono representation for almost the entirety of it. And as a result, he really didn't have very much out-of-pocket expense there. There was some minimal expenses, I believe. And when I say minimal, I'm talking like $30,000. I don't know how much has come in, and I don't know how much has gone out. So I don't want to sit there and make misrepresentations to your audience and what have you. But it's been a lot. And it's the same problem that every one of these families has. They're not kidding. When you hear a criminal defendant say the process is the punishment, they're not joking. Because what you know prosecutors have done is bankrupt families. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's devastating. Why we should be talking seriously about things like whether or not we should be removing qualified immunity and sovereign immunity from, you know, prosecutors and judges for various violations. Like if we're talking about like gross negligence and what could be argued to be criminal acts, maybe we should be talking about removing immunity and making people personally liable. You know, maybe we should be talking about changing, you know, real criminal justice reform, because this isn't a new thing. It's just you've got an entirely new community that's talking about it now. And I don't think we should be, you know, pointing fingers. We, as the ones out here who are affected, I think we all need to start coming together and be like, yeah, arm in arm, we are now standing together to sit there and fix this problem, because now we all know.
Yeah, and in one way or another, it's going to affect us all. And if you've never been harassed by a state or federal apparatus, and if you've never experienced that, that's what's so funny. You get like, well, obviously he's in jail. He must have done something wrong, you know? And if you've never been harassed by a federal or state or a bureaucratic apparatus, I mean, you really don't know what life's about. And, you know, people that have experienced that, went through it, survived, and financially survived, it always involves like incredible financial punitive. It's very expensive. It's very painful. It's very emotional. And it's incredibly dismissive for people, for like normie people that are just oblivious to the issues of the day, to make like very uninformed statements like, well, obviously he must be a really bad dude if he's facing these federal arms charges. And it's just, you know, the world doesn't work like that. And there does need to be, if we are going to have justice in America again, there has to be massive reform within our judicial system and some way to control these costs. Because like you said, the real punishment is paying for the process. I mean, the punitive damages are way before punitive damages are assigned. I mean, the entire process is a punitive damage.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm going to go back to what you said about speaking out, hearing true stories in a second. But yeah, I mean, here's the thing that people don't realize. The food you get in jail, and they probably know, it's terrible. So what do most of these guys do? They go to commissary and they try and get, you know, supplement the trash that they're fed with a little bit better. That's an expense. Every time they want to call home, that's an expense. Every time they want to write an email, that's an expense. Every time that they are subjected to diesel therapy, which is moving you from one location to another location to another location, they leave everything that they've had but behind. So if they bought sweatshirts and whatnot because it's cold, they don't get to take those with them. It stays there. So they have to buy it again. Any commissary that they had, it stays there. They buy it again. The amount of financial impact to people is, I mean, what I've learned in the past couple of years is terrifying to me. But I do want to talk about what you said about, you know, the message and not hearing what the true story is from the other side. I'd recommend anyone sit there and ask a January 6er whether or not they had a gag order from a judge that said, if you talk about your case, you'll be facing criminal penalties. Because it happened to Donald Trump, and it happened to a bunch of January 6ers. I don't know if it happened to all of them, but it happened to a bunch of them. So first off, they've got this problem where they can't speak out because they could be held accountable for it. Then you have defense attorneys. And defense attorneys, you know, their job is to act in the best interest of their clients. And part of the reason a defense attorney will tell you, you know, don't say anything, don't speak to the public, blah, 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 is because anything you say can and will be used against you. And they're not joking when they say that. You know, they will go in and they will take jailhouse communications between you and your loved ones, you and your friends. I mean, and theoretically, between you and your lawyer, based on what we saw in January 6th, where they said, well, used our digital systems for these text messages with this person. So that's fair game. So it's almost impossible to have a legitimate conversation with the way that this is. I mean, is it any question that we're at like a 99%, you know, conviction rate when we talk about criminal cases? You know, if we can't sit there and force you into submission through bankruptcy, then we'll sit there and we'll stifle your voice. And the prosecution doesn't have their voice stifled. The prosecution will make statements to the public all the time, and the news will happily cover it. I've never seen a David and Goliath situation truly like this. I mean, it was something, you know, that I personally never sat there and thought of because it never truly directly impacted me. And shame on me for that, because, you know, this, like I said, this isn't new to January 6th. This is how the game is played.
Yeah, just like you were mentioning about the prison system, I mean, to my knowledge, all the prisons are privately owned, and it's a gigantic, well, it's a massive money-making machine, and I know that there's many in the District of Criminals, or Washington, D.C., whatever you want to call them, that, you know, when they're investigating how these Congress critters went only making $200,000 a year, and how are they now worth $20 million or $200 million, there's massive revenue streams coming from our prison system. And, you know, it'd be great if this shined light on that too, because if you're going to fix the justice system, part and parcel, we're going to have to fix the private prison system as well.
Well, I agree. Well, first, I don't know how many of the prisons are private. I know that there are private corporations that have made it a business to engage in, you know, criminal retention and, you know, what have you. Are they all? I don't know. There might be a large chunk. And I don't know if there's a difference when we start talking about state versus federal.
Sure.
That's
sure.
Well beyond my knowledge. And I can't sit there and say that, you know, how someone might benefit from, you know, what have you. But, you know, Doge has done a really good job of sitting there and starting to connect some dots. And there's a lot of people who are getting very unsettled by what Elon Musk and his team are doing. And, you know, there's an old adage, follow the money. You know, I think Elon Musk is legitimately just following the money. And he's going wherever that takes him. And I'm very grateful that he is.
Yeah. So there's a hearing coming on March 6th, and then could there be a potential positive outcome at that hearing, or is that just to schedule the next court date?
No, there will be no more court dates theoretically after that. You know, as his appellate counsel has said, Michael Ufferman, who is probably one of the top criminal defense appellate lawyers in Florida. When you hear somebody who quote-unquote wrote the book, that was Michael. He began by saying, we're in a much better place by the fact that we have oral arguments. He said, If we weren't getting oral arguments, it's not a good it's not a good sign. Okay. So it's a good sign that we're there. Basically, what's happening there is the judges may or may not have made up their minds as to where they are. They've got points that are based on what they've read that they want further clarification and further discussion on. What happens then is the government and Jeremy's attorneys both go in and they argue the points and what have you, and they fill in and answer all the questions. Think of it like a hearing in front of Congress, except you got three judges in front of you instead of a committee. And then from that point forward, the panel of the three judges will sit there and take it under advisement of everything they heard, and they will come up with their decision based on the documents in front of them and any further clarification that they got. That theoretically could be the end of it. There are other things that can be done where Jeremy's lawyer can call for a hearing in front of all of the judges in the 11th Circuit, not just a three-judge panel. I'm not an appellate attorney by any means. You know, I never wanted to get into that area of law. I believe it's when the court hears the case in bank is when the entirety of the appellate group comes in. That's a possibility. There's a possibility of going back down to the lower court based on issues concerning what has taken place under a different federal statute, which I can't remember off the top of my head. And, you know, so there are options that are there. And then, of course, you know, the ultimate option, which you're talking about yet again, somewhere probably between $100,000 and $200,000 for a case in front of the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court would even hear it.
Right. And that takes years, usually. I forget how many years on average it takes to even appeal to the Supreme Court, and then they actually have to accept the case, and it's an incredibly expensive delayed process. So there is a substantial possibility on March 6th to have some resolutions, but it's not necessarily. Would there be any additional? Could there potentially be any additional sentencing at that time? Or
no. I mean, at that point in time, they can't add anything onto them from that point forward. All you can do is take away.
Okay.
You know, it's.
Currently, how much time is he facing?
I believe his release date is December 27, 2027.
He's been in now
since September 30, 2021. All based on an unlawful search and seizure.
If this gets thrown out, is there any type of remediation, financial remediation for him? Does he have any recourse to at least recuperate his legal fees?
Okay, so I've seen people who've kind of thrown out, we're doing this class action, we're doing that class action. And when I hear and I see stuff in the media, it piques my interest, which has caused me to go in and look at some of this stuff. And when you're talking about suing the federal government, you want to talk about the deck being stacked against you? It's stacked against you. Like, worse than anything I've seen before. If my understanding of what I've read is accurate, I mean, you basically have to send a complaint letter to the various agencies that you've got an issue with. And then they've got 6 months that they can sit there and respond to you. And then eclipse 6 months, or they say, yeah, we're not negotiating or what have you, and they give you some kind of final letter, then you can sit there and go to court. But when you go to court, under the Federal Tort Claims Act, you don't get a jury trial. You get a bench trial, which means a judge determines everything. And that judge is not going to give you punitive damages. So we hear about punitive damages all the time. Somebody does something really, really bad. Your total damage, your out-of-pocket expense is like $100,000. And, the jury says emotional distress as a result of it, that's $500,000. And then you got something called punitive damages, which is basically to punish the party so that they never do it again. And you sit there, and that's where you see these astronomical numbers from time to time, $30 million, $50 million, stuff like that. So that, we know you've got a lot of money, and we know that all this other stuff is never going to sit there and force you to sit there and correct your behavior. So we're going to punish you so that you don't do it again. You don't get punitive damages when you're suing the federal government. Mm. You may have to sit there and go into a court. that you don't want to be in. For example, you might be forced to sit there and file a claim in the District of Columbia. Well, how much luck are you going to have bringing a civil suit against the federal government based on what we saw January 6th? So I'm not an expert in this stuff. You know, while I was perusing through Twitter, X, whatever it's called today, I happened to see somebody who referenced a lawyer out of Missouri. I don't know what his name is off the top of my head, but I saw some stuff that he had posted and what have you. And, you know, for what I do for Jeremy, because I'm not on any of his dockets, I'm his logistics lawyer. You know, what he tells me he needs to get done, you know, it's I go out and I do whatever he really needs me to do. You know, if he tells me, you know, I need you to go contact this lawyer to make sure this happens, that's what I do. You know, I've sat there when he was meeting with his, you know, appellate lawyer. Jeremy wants to be able to provide his own feedback. But if you rely on the way that the prison system goes as to when they get mail in, he'd never be able to communicate with his lawyer in a quick enough time to make that, you know, a feasible thing. So his lawyer might send me whatever he's doing. I would arrange a face-to-face visit. Jeremy and I would go through everything that's there. He would put his notes on it. We would have two copies, one copy that he would be able to maintain so that he could have an intelligent conversation with his appellate lawyer after the fact. I would take his handwritten notes, scan them in, send them up to his appellate lawyer, and they can sit there and do their job.
How many lawyers are involved for Jeremy on this side?
I mean, it depends how you sit there and look at it. And it's not just how many are there now. It's how many has he gone through. So, I mean, he had what's called a CJA counsel, which is basically a public defender that you get who is a private attorney when the public defender's office has a conflict with you. So he had a CJA counsel in Tampa. He had a trial counsel for Tampa. Then he had me just kind of roaming around trying to sit there and help him out. He's got his appellate lawyer. He's got, you know, in his DC case, he had his original CJA counsel. His CJA counsel was let go. He ended up getting, He ended up getting two guys that represented him for a little bit and they had a falling out because they weren't a good fit for each other between the lawyers and Jeremy. They were replaced by a lawyer who took him almost up to the point of trial, and she was in D.C., and she was replaced in D.C., and then he had his D.C. counsel. So, I mean, right there, and technically, the guys that were going to represent him in D.C., there was two of them, so we're talking nine lawyers.
Wow. I know you recently talked to Jeremy. How's his spirits? How's he feeling?
I mean, you know, I think he's rightfully upset. You know, there's stuff that, you know, is happening that I can't talk about right now, but, you know, there's stuff that he's very upset about. You know, he's trying to maintain a positive mindset, but I mean, it's tough for him in the sense that, you know, he's locked up and he sees everybody else that's out. And when he hears that, you know, we're now down to four January Sixers left in, because I believe one was either let out yesterday or in the process of being let out, I believe we're at four that are still incarcerated, Benjamin Martin and Jeremy Brown. Those are the two that I know because of how similar I believe their cases are in a lot of regards. The other two, I apologize because I really should know their names. I mean, at this point, there's four of them. So, I mean, I really should know the other two gentlemen. But I believe you got four that are locked in. Then you've got people that either had charges dismissed or they're getting new charges now that it appears that the government's coming after. And I haven't spent a lot of time looking at that, but I mean, it doesn't even look like it's entirely over at this point. I'm hoping now that Cash Patel is in, some of that stuff stops. And I'm hoping that, you know, now that the president has essentially fired all of the United States attorneys for, you know, that were holdovers from the Biden administration, that all of the acting United States attorneys are like, okay, president has spoken. We need to, you know, I'm hoping that what we're starting to see is people recognize that, look, you know, we've got to stop doing this. So for
everyone listening, do you have any recommendations or action steps, anything that they can do to help?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Here is the thing. Jeremy is the January Sixer that you will is the only January 6th you'll see me openly, truly advocate for. And it's because he's the client I work for. And I will sit there and I'll say, you share his story. If you have the means to, and your heart so compels you, contribute to his legal defense fund at, you know, jeremybrowndefense.com. Because, you know, this may end up being over tomorrow. This might be going on for another 2 years. Who knows? But, you know, if for some reason you have some reason that you don't sit there and want to connect to Jeremy Brown, find another January 6er. I mean, you're talking about men and women. What is it? 1,600 plus families that have been decimated. You're talking about people that can't get jobs. You're talking about people who may have lost their homes. You're talking about people that may be out on the street. You know, this is that opportunity for all of us to sit there and show a little bit of compassion to all of them.
Yeah. You know,
it's this should be a point where we sit there and we stop looking at, you know, the details that the government is telling us about. We start listening to people that sat there and said, you know, look what happened.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I wanted to have you on. I appreciate you squeezing me into your busy schedule. Every guest on the Fearless Podcast gets a gift. Chris, do you drink coffee?
I drink coffee, and I'd love to find a way to sit there and get it into the jail, because I'm sure Jeremy'd love an actual good glass of coffee himself.
Well, I'll gladly text me your mailing address. And let me know if you want whole bean or ground, and we'll get you out. And what kind of, if you like light, medium, or dark roast. We also have a new white roast, which is really cool. It's high in caffeine. But I appreciate all your time. We're going to link, we're going to have a link to Jeremy's information down below. If you want to, if you have a link that of that one document you referenced, if you have a link to that, I can throw that in the show notes as well. But this has been a great conversation. I just want you all, if y'all want to know what to do, like and share this podcast, send it to your friends and family so that they're informed, because I promise you, if you went out today and you asked 100 people, who is Jeremy Brown, I could almost guarantee that nobody would know what you were talking about. And then if you go and say, oh, well, he's a January 6er, and then they're going to say, oh, yeah, but all those guys got released. Well, we just learned today that there are still four still being prosecuted. So the best thing we can do from this side is to share this information. If you can financially help him, absolutely do that. But there is an inordinate amount of power in shining the light on this and sharing this information. Chris, is there, in closing, is there anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
Yeah, I want them to know this. Jeremy Brown is the one January 6th defendant that never had to be there. He was recruited by the to be a confidential human source, which means they never wanted him to see. He never had to come forward and release that audio and give analysis to warn us. And when the government offered him a plea deal to sit there and make everything other than his two weapon charges go away, he refused to take a knee. He sat there and he has stood in the gap for all of us in a way I have never seen before. And for that reason, he truly does deserve all of our support.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. The other thing, if you go listen to that audio, the first time you listen to it, you might not connect the dots, but where those FBI agents say, oh, we're going to a bunch of people today, you know, they were recruiting these confidential sources and it was going to be a group of individuals. Yeah, so it's really incredible when you think about that kind of stuff. But Chris, this has been great. I appreciate your time. And like I said, y'all, please share this with your friends and family. And let's at least spread the word. It's the least that we can do for someone that is being federally tortured by our government, you know, just because he loves the country and wanted to inform us of the debauchery that was going on. So the least we can do is spread the information. And I appreciate y'all and love y'all. If you like our information, go on over to thetexasboys.com and check out our products over there. And we will see y'all on the next show.